Welcome, guys, to episode 138 of Behind the Shield podcast. As always, my name's James Gearing, and this introduction is going to be a little bit longer because I really need to set the stage for my next guest. As a firefighter paramedic for 14 years, I have lost count of how many people I've lost as far as patients due to opiate overdose and other drug-related either crimes or overdoses. As a firefighter paramedic, I have also been heartbroken to see how many of my peers in my profession, law enforcement, have succumbed to this addiction as well. And we've lost numerous people to overdoses. So this is very, very close to my heart. And as you guys probably know, if you've listened to the podcast for a while, I look outside our country's barriers for solutions if they're not within the U.S. We had Tom Eberhardt on the show, who was the governor of Bastøy, the prison in Norway, and the incredible prison system that they have over there. And I was fortunate enough, having two of my family members living in Portugal, to be told that Portugal actually decriminalized drug use. Now, not drug sales, not drug smuggling, but the user, the addict, became viewed as a medical patient, not a criminal, unlike what we do here in England and many other places around the world. And prior to this happening, they had an epidemic. They went from a dictatorship and then just got absolutely saturated with drugs and basically had one of the highest levels of addiction, HIV, and all the associated problems that we see with drugs in the whole of Europe. When they decriminalized this, and what happened was they went to the people had basically had enough, and the people pushed this vote. So imagine that, the actual people of driving the country. They had forums and cinemas and theaters, and this was pushed through. And within about 10 years, they had gone from the highest level of addiction to the lowest level of addiction. Their HIV, their crime, all the associated problems that you have with drug addiction fell as well, and they revolutionized the country. So I was fortunate enough to be in Portugal last week for my little brother's wedding. And I reached out to my guest, Dr. João Goulao, who is the General Director for Intervention on Addictive Behaviors and Dependency, to give him his full title. But simply put, was one of the men that actually spearheaded this decriminalization going through. And it was an incredible interview. So he talks about setting the scene, what Portugal was like before, why there was such a drug problem after some of the wars that the Portuguese soldiers have been in, and then how this was pushed through, like I said, by the progressive politicians and the people. They reached out to the people and the people spoke. And then the amazing success they've had, and then some of the issues they've had trying to bring that model to other countries. And that's why I do this podcast, is the only way that we're going to have something like this in England, in the US, and anyone else that's listening that has this kind of epidemic in their country is us, the people, the citizens, the first responders, hearing of a model like this and starting to push and question those that can start the ball rolling and make this model in our country. There is no reason why we can't do that. To underline a statistic from when I spoke to Tom, in the US, in America specifically, in the 1970s, we had about 330,000 prisoners. Today, 2018, we have 2.3 million prisoners. So whatever political rhetoric is being thrown around, the bottom line is our quote-unquote war on drugs and war on crime is not working, and we need to reinvent the way we do prisons, the way we look at addiction, to make our streets safer and try and reduce the violent crime and all the horrendous things that we see happening every day. This will empty out our prisons, make life on the street a lot safer for our first responders, make our schools safer, and lessen the chance of any of our family members having addiction. Just to point out what Portugal's was like, 1% of their country, 1% was addicted. That is a huge statistic. Every single family pretty much had an addict in their family. So with that all being said, to take this model and then revolutionize the health of a country, I think is extremely powerful. So I urge you to listen to this, but most importantly, I urge you to share it as well. Because I always ask at the end of every episode, please share. this needs to go viral. This needs to be heard by every single person on the planet so that we understand that there is a solution over and above arresting drug users at the ground level and throwing them into a prison where chances are their addiction is going to get worse. As I always say, please subscribe to the show. Please go on iTunes or whatever you use. Give us a rating, give us a review. And with that being said, I introduce to you Dr. João Goulart. Enjoy. I want to start by welcoming Dr. Goulart to the podcast. I want to preface this by saying that we are sitting in his office, so thank you so much for having us.
Thank you. Thank you for your visit.
Thank you. And we're in Lisbon, in Portugal. So I always like to start with a very brief history of who you are and where you're from. So were you born in Lisbon here?
No. I'm from a small city in the interior, Sertã. Mid-Portugal. but I worked for several years in the Algarve since I ended my course of medicine from 1980 to 97. And then, meanwhile, I started to work in the field of addictions. And in 97, I became the responsible for the network, for the Portuguese network, addressing those problems. So since then, I'm the responsible for those policies.
Okay. So, and you went to traditional medical school before as
a
doctor?
Yes.
Okay.
Here in Lisbon.
In Lisbon. Yeah. Okay. So you kind of came back to where you started.
Yes.
So just before we talk about, where we are now, what was the education on addiction and use of pain medication when you went through your traditional training?
Well, almost none. Almost none. The drugs problems in Portugal started later than in most of the European countries. As you know, probably we lived for a long time under a dictatorship, during which we had no drugs problems. We were protected to the evil of drugs. It was the Salazar dictatorship. I don't know if it sounds to you, but it ended in 1974 with our democratic revolution. But by the end of the ancient regime, in the last decade, we were dealing with a colonial war in our ancient colonies of Angola, Mozambique, and so on.
Right.
Okay. And at that time, it happened a little bit the same that happened with Americans in Vietnam. Drug use down there was tolerated or even incentivated.
Right. So while in the soldiers here, themselves?
Yes.
Okay.
While here in mainland, it was severely repressed.
Yeah? Right.
Suddenly, after the democratic revolution, our carnation revolution, we had the return of all those soldiers and settlers from the ancient colonies that came back to mainland with their habits and bringing literally tons of, at least of cannabis,
mm-hmm. yeah,
that suddenly was made available for everybody.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, and the drug use spread very, very... was very fast. And what is important to mention, in my view, is that it raised among all social classes, social groups. Okay, it was not something that happened only among disorganized people or minorities.
It
happens through mid-class, medium-class, high classes, everybody. So suddenly everybody was using, starting with cannabis. Of course, some criminal organizations came into our territory, bringing all the others that were made available. So suddenly everything was available. Heroin, cocaine, LSD, you name it, in a completely unprepared society. Yeah? Yeah. Suddenly everything was available. And that was something that came with freedom. So that was a kind of attraction for everybody to experiment. And as we were completely naive about drugs, it was easy to shift from one to the other. So the Escalade at that time was really present. It was easy to start with cannabis and then jump into heroin, cocaine, whatever. Okay? So suddenly in just a couple of years, in a decade, it was almost impossible to find a Portuguese family that had no problems related to drugs. Okay? Yeah. So it started to become higher and higher in the ranking of political priorities by the impact in public health and individual health. AIDS came along to complicate things at that time. Okay, so in the 80s, and it started to attain all families. Coming back to your question about my training, I had almost no training at the university, but working from the beginning of the 80s in the Algarve as a family doctor, I started to be confronted with problems, with people coming to me, families or even individuals, young people or less young, coming to me and seeking for help to deal with their dependency. I got involved on that, started to study about it. I was available. It was my only tool. The only tool that I had was being available and being willing to help people. But I had no technical preparation for it. So when the opportunity came to attend a training here in Lisbon, at the center of Taipas, which was our first big center addressing those problems, I was invited to attend a training for 6 months, which I did, working with colleagues in a daily basis and shoulder by shoulder and watching what they were doing. And then I went back to the Algarve with the capacity to open, to create the first center down there to address these problems. So I slowly moved from my general practice into becoming deeper more and more involved in this problematic. Okay? So I moved from the general working from a general as a general practitioner into a more addressed activity to this area. And it happened until 97, down there from 1980 until 97. In 97, I was invited by the Minister of Health to become the coordinator of the network that meanwhile had been created. And since then, I'm in charge.
You're the man.
Yeah.
Well, I want to ask you a couple of things about what you said. So firstly, when Portugal was a dictatorship, how were they successfully able to keep drugs out the country during then?
You know, we were a very isolated and very controlled society. We had a very strong political police. It was almost impossible for us to travel abroad because of the war, mostly for male young population. It was almost impossible because you needed a military license to travel even to Spain or whatever. It was very complicated and people just gave up. I had never traveled abroad before our revolution. So I was 20 at the time, never crossed the border before. On the other side, we were not a very sexy destination for visitors to come. Okay, so we lived in a closed, poor, sad. It was not a very nice society, you know. Of course, there were, I cannot be sure that there was no drug use. Some purses, some small
isolated cases.
Yeah. Some health professionals, for instance, that could assess some substances at the hospitals and so on. But it was not a massive subject.
Right.
Okay. I cannot say, okay, we didn't have any drugs available. It's not true. But it was not a massive problem.
Yeah.
After that, yes, it was. There was an after the revolution, there was an explosion. The state was dealing with many other problems and did not pay attention to this one for a while.
Yeah.
So people, even if our law on drugs was quite repressive and inspired in the ideas of the war on drugs, in fact, it was not very effective.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, well, that brings me to the next question, because as you know, from where I come from, England and America, war on drugs, especially in America, is our term, you know.
Yep.
And in my very basic, you know, knowledge of what I see at work, it doesn't appear to be working. We're not winning that war at all. So if you wouldn't mind, that leading up to year 2000, what were the initial tactics of what you were trying to do to combat drugs? And then obviously we can talk about how you changed, you know, the whole shift.
Yes. No, of course, there was the supply side activity, by police forces and the customs and so on. They were quite active on that basis. But from the beginning, we started to work with users, and mostly with problematic drug users, on the demand side, on offering them treatment when needed, developing preventive work, trying to inform and to talk about problems and the differences between the several substances available and so on. Very, very early, we started to develop some harm reduction policies, such as syringe exchange. I must say that on the mindset of the population, it was facilitated by the fact that it was cross-cutting all society, as I told you.
Okay, yeah, so okay? All different classes and races.
Yeah,
right.
So it's different if you have, for instance, a medium-class housewife discussing with the priest. Okay. Oh, my boy has problems. Okay, he's not a criminal. He's someone in need of help. Okay, and this makes this idea made his way among our society. I would say that our policies are mostly known because we decriminalized drug use. And you may think it was a bright idea from some illuminated politician or professional or whatever. I must say that I feel that it was a kind of a bottom-up movement
among
society, okay? And politicians and the law came just to confirm and to ensure that that was the way to address it, okay? So, and it made the difference. Of course, we were prior to that decriminalization, we were working in the development of a network of centers for treatment, a network of therapeutic communities. We have a kind of a complementarity between the state-run facilities and the NGO-run. We do not compete. We just complement ourselves,
mm-hmm.
Which is good.
Yes, doesn't happen everywhere.
Yeah. The state supplies mostly outpatient treatment, and inpatient clinics such as therapeutic communities are mostly run by NGOs, and we pay for it. Okay, so we pay for each patient that is, and this is good instead of being all the existing tension between both sides. So we started to work in to develop a network of treatment facilities. We started working in prevention, in harm reduction, in reintegration of people prior to decriminalization. But decriminalization introduced a kind of a coherency in all this, okay? Because everything was based in the idea that we were dealing mostly with a health condition and social condition rather than a criminal one.
Yeah, okay. A huge shift.
Yeah. And everything changes because people tend to admit, okay, we are dealing with a disease, a chronic relapsing disease, with the same dignity as other diseases. And patients who suffer from it have the same dignity as other patients. Okay, it's not a sin. It's not a. It's not a vicious. So this change allowed us to have the support for focused policies, for instance, in terms of reintegration. It's not easy to have a positive discrimination towards employment of drug addicts if it is a crime. Mm-hmm. Okay? But if we consider, okay, it's an important step in the recovery of people, reintegration of people in society, being able to have a normal life. Under this framework of decriminalization is much easier. Okay? And a part of the specific way that we did the decriminalization with the creation of dissuasion commissions, I don't know if you heard about it. I'll explain briefly how things work in practice, okay? Yeah, but let's go there. But for the moment, saying that under this framework, all those policies on the demand side are much more coherent and well accepted by a society. What happens in practice? Well, I must say that decriminalization was included in our first strategy. That was approved in 1999. It was proposed to the government by a group of experts, nine people, from judges to psychiatrists, psychologists, and so on. I was included in that group. So we were invited to present a report on the situation and with strategic proposals, okay? And we did it on the supply side, but mostly on the demand side. All the strategy was based in the idea that we were dealing with a health and social issue, and in line with that, we proposed the decriminalization. The strategy was adopted in 1999, but the issue of decriminalization had to be discussed at the parliament, which happened only in 2000. Okay? So only in 2000 we had the conditions to go further with them. And since then, well, I must say that all the available indicators have been dropping, and we feel quite comfortable with this decision. How does it happen in practice? If a citizen is intercepted by the police using drugs, or in possession of drugs is conducted to the police station as before. The drug is apprehended as before. It is weighted, evaluated in terms of amount, and there's a table with the amounts for each substance that constitute the threshold. If you have more drugs on you than the calculated amount for 10 days personal use, you go to the criminal system as before.
Because it seems like you're selling at that point.
Yes.
Right.
Okay. So you go for court, for investigation, trial, so on. Okay?
Yeah.
Criminal system as before. If you have less than that amount on you, you are just intimated to present yourself to a commission, the Commission for Dissuasion of Drug Addiction, which is a body under the Ministry of Health, okay, that is constituted by three people, a lawyer, a jurist, a psychologist, and a social worker, usually, okay? You go there. In the next 72 hours, you must present yourself there. And then you have an interview, you have a, there's a report that the technical team prepares, and then the commission evaluates your situation. It informs you about the fact that using drugs is still illegal. It is not a crime, it's not under the criminal law, but it is a misdemeanor.
Misdemeanor, yeah. Misdemeanor. In America, it's a misdemeanor. Yes.
That's the term, you can compare it to the use or not use of the safety belt when you drive, okay? It's not a crime, you do not go to jail, you never get a criminal record for it, but you may have a fine, or in thesis you may may be obliged to attend a training course for drivers, for instance, okay?
So, and then same with the seatbelt.
The same with...
So you're doing it because... You're actually trying to prevent the illness and death of this person. So you're not punishing them so much as trying to bring them back to good health.
That's it. That's it. That's the idea. And, the commission tries to assess, okay, are you an addicted person, a problematic drug user or not? Or just a social, recreational, occasional user? Okay, this is the first step to... If you are an addicted person, you are invited to join a treatment facility. But you are free to refuse. It's not mandatory. Okay?
Oh, okay.
Okay. Okay. Have you ever thought about treating yourself? Well, okay. Yes, I've been thinking about it, but it's so complicated. Do you think so? What about tomorrow? Let's start tomorrow. You have an appointment? I can find you an appointment for... Okay, let's go. Phone call, Dr. X, is it possible to have a new client tomorrow? Okay, the day after tomorrow. Okay, 10 o'clock, you have Dr. X expecting you. Yeah. Most of them accept.
Because you've made it so easy, you paved the way for them.
Yes, that's a red carpet, you know?
Yes.
Okay. So... I'm not saying they are going to be successful in that treatment process, but they start. At least they start the process. They know the people. It facilitates the assess. But you are free to refuse. Okay, I don't want anything. Okay, you are free to refuse. Your file stands open for, let's say, for 6 months. Please don't come back in the next 6 months. Otherwise, I have to apply you a penalty. Okay? And the penalty may be, there's a long list of it, never a criminal record, never imprisonment, but you may have, for drug addicts, never a fine, a financial fine, but you may have social work or the obligation to attend some consultations. For instance, you are HIV positive, you must attend your consultations. You have to go there every month or every 2 months and bring me a piece of paper showing that you have been there. So it increases the compliance for other kind of problems.
Okay. So are you suggesting then that charging a drug user a fine might not be the best way of doing it, seeing as they're probably broke?
It is not possible.
It doesn't make sense, does it?
Yeah. But if you are just a social user, okay, I have no problems with drugs. I smoke a joint on weekends with friends. Even then, must be informed that this is not illicit activity. This is illegal. Okay. Now you are informed. Okay? Anyway, during the interview, I understand. Okay, my parents are divorcing, or my father just lost his job, or myself, I have some problems with some psychological difficulties. I have problems with assuming my gender choices or whatever.
Yeah.
Okay.
And using the drugs to cope with it.
So. Okay, let's leave the drugs problems. But even then, I may offer you any help. Okay, do you think, would you like to have a talk with a psychologist to help you to deal with that? Or with a social worker that can help your family to deal with unemployment? So even then, we try to address people to the appropriate responses, not in a center for the treatment of drug addiction, but for other responses in society and to help people to deal with those difficulties. The goal is to interrupt a career that later on may lead you to more difficulties with drugs. Drugs may enhance its position in your life.
Yeah, because you're with that one, the drugs are the symptom, aren't they? And you're addressing the cause, which is the trauma psychologically they're trying to deal with or get away from.
Yeah. So, with this approach, of course, most of the people that are presented to those commissions are not addicted people; are just social users. Okay. In a proportion of, 80% of non-addicted to 20% of addicted.
Okay.
But even then, we try to offer them any kind of help when needed. We just can assume, okay, drugs are not a problem, in life, his studies are going well. So we are not too much intrusive. We inform people, but the same approach. Okay, you are not willing to have any kind of, you don't feel you need any kind of help. You're free to go. Okay, please don't come back in the next times. Otherwise, we may apply you a fine or other kind of penalties also. Okay? So the term is to dissuade. I don't know if it sounds also in English.
It does. I love the fact that's the name of the program, dissuasion.
Yeah, dissuasion. And of course, this is only one of the gates for the system. You can assess it directly, spontaneously, or referred by your family doctor or your teacher or whatever. Okay.
Okay. So there's multiple avenues to get down the same path.
Yeah. Well, so this is part of our package of policies. Okay. It works. I must say that in the beginning, when decriminalization was discussed at Parliament, there was a huge discussion. Prior to that discussion, the proponents of the idea, we organized a huge number of public sessions to discuss with the population. And what I keep from that period is that people tended mostly to accept the idea and to be in favor of the idea of decriminalization.
Mm. So, and you were literally, as a nation, you were listening to the people, like, yes, you said, from the ground up.
Yes,
and they were steering this policy.
We organized the sessions in cinemas with a huge attendance, 500 people, big discussions, but mostly people tended to accept this idea. When things came to the parliament, things were a little bit more complicated, with left-wing parties supporting the idea, proposing the idea, and right-wing parties, the hard line, saying, the treaties, the United Nations treaties, the United Nations are going to blame us, to crucify us. Portugal will become a paradise for drug addicts from all over the world. We will have planes coming to Lisbon or to Porto every day with people to use drugs freely. Our children will start using drugs with a milk bottle. You know, that kind of...
scare tactics. Yeah.
But by the end of the day, it was approved with a majority and came into force in the 1st of July of 2001. Okay. Nowadays, there's a consensus. There's no party trying to go back. Because the results were so good, so convenient, that there's a consensus in our society, even at the political level, about the so-called Portuguese model. So, of course, now there are other discussions over the table. Legalize, regulate markets. Okay, but as we stand, as far as we stand in this decriminalization model, there's an absolute consensus.
Okay, now I just want to kind of highlight an area that I've seen you talk about on some of the documentaries that you've done or you've been in. So when you decriminalized the drugs, and like you said, just to be clear, the user's drug, not the smugglers, not the people selling them, those people are still hunted down and yep. penalized. What was the effect on the addicts that before were scared of going to jail? Once it was decriminalized, did they start realizing that it was safe to come out, as it were, and seek treatment now?
It facilitated the approach of those users to the centers. Yeah. That leads us back to the dictatorship. During that, people were scared to seek for help because they were afraid of being referred to the police forces. And this idea was still present in the first years after revolution. You know? So, okay. So still fear to being referred and to being... But after that, it facilitated. Everybody was felt free to assume that they have problems in workplace, in everywhere, in school. Okay, I need help. I go there, but and I don't lose my job because of seeking for help. I don't have any kind of legal problems with it. So it facilitated and. It allowed us to discuss drugs problems, addiction problems in every setting, okay? In families, in workplace, in schools. It's no longer taboo, you know? Yeah. You can discuss it freely without fearing to be, I must avoid assuming that because I might have consequences.
Mm-hmm. That. Yeah. And by decriminalizing it, I'm looking at all the problems that make addiction worse in England and in America. So you throw them in jail or in prison. Obviously, their addiction is going to get worse. And I just found out, supposedly, that they withdrew all the addiction help in the prison systems in Florida, which is insane, if that's correct. So now they're... criminals as well, and like you said, you come out with a criminal record and now you're trying to find employment. You're not going to get employment. Now you're in the vicious circle. What you guys have done is now you're not a criminal. You come out and you're actually assisted to find work when you come out of the rehabilitation program.
That's it. It's one of the one of the consequences, of course.
Yeah. Okay, so what about the effect on law enforcement, on the police? So is it, what are they seeing through their eyes now as far as, obviously not having to arrest, or let me rephrase that, not constantly chasing addicts, but are they able to direct their resources now to the real problem, which is the smugglers and the dealers?
That is correct. The usual way to work for police forces was that you pick a drug user on the street, you shake a little bit, you have some information, you have where did you buy it, you go to next corner dealer, then you go there and you pick and shake again, you have some information, you climb two steps in the stairs of traffic, right. Yeah? But you do not go further. And by the end of the day, you pick some grams or kilos of substances, but nothing but that. In this new framework, the police forces have lost their source, this source of information. So they had to learn how to work differently, kind of top-down, by increasing the sharing of information with international police and customs forces, with intelligence, and so they can address. They got rid of those tasks of preparing files for trial of drug users, yeah. Okay? Huge amount of paperwork, and so they got rid of all that. They just sent those people to the health system. Okay, it's up to you to deal with them. So they could address the sharks instead of the small fishes. They could address the sharks. By the end of the year, when they show their results, and the metrics is still the amount seized, okay, they show tons of cocaine, heroin, and so on, that they seize in open sea and in containers, bulk traffic, instead of the small traffic on the street. Yeah. Okay? So if the goal is to lower the availability of drugs at street level, you are much more effective by going higher and cutting
the head off the snake.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Instead of trying to pick the little fit of it.
Yeah. And you've done it from both ends too, because the other way is supply and demand. If you take away the demand, they're not going to want to do it as much.
But this work on supply is very important because, you know, Portugal is one of the gateways for drugs for the European market. Okay, cocaine mostly from Latin America is coming here, hashish from Morocco. So we have, and we have a very exposed coast.
Yes.
So we need the effective activity in lowering that that availability. Some of those drugs are addressing the Portuguese market, but most of them are just passing through. Okay, so it's important that international cooperation and those that activity on intelligence and all that to address this availability. So I must say that on the first times of decriminalization, police forces were not very happy about it.
Yeah, well, it's change. So, yeah.
But nowadays they are the most enthusiastic people about this model, because in fact they can address what is really important instead of spending their time working in a never-ending work, which leads to nowhere.
Well, I'm sure, like you said, that the police reports and all their paperwork, but also the court system must have opened up tremendously when you took all the users out of it.
Yeah. So this is, and with that, I think an important part of our policies also, of our system, is the existence of coordinating bodies. No? The member of the Portuguese government, which is responsible for drugs policies, is the Minister of Health. Okay? And on his behalf, the general director of SICA, myself, in this case, I act as the national coordinator. And I work directly with personal representatives of 11 ministers. Okay? Justice, home affairs, education, you name it. Okay? So, and we coordinate our policies, we build our strategic documents together, we evaluate them, the action plans and all that. So, I know, I interact with the supply side representatives, we agree in some priorities, and we work not in a daily basis together, but every 2-3 months we meet and we discuss what a part of the main documents, main strategy, there are some new things that we must adapt to.
Yeah, so just to make sure I'm understanding it, so to make it work, all the different elements of the system, whether it's, like you said, attacking the suppliers all the way through to the addicts and the health side, you're all working with each other to make sure that the chain doesn't break. Okay.
And I think it's from what I know at European level, and not only at European level, we have one of the most effective coordination system at world level, because it really works. We keep informed, we keep in line one with the others, we build new legislation, for instance, around new psychoactive substances. For instance, we have the judiciary police, the forensics, we have the participation of all the bodies, which is defined by law. It's not in a voluntary basis. Okay.
Now, one thing I want to kind of underline as well. So before, when you had the crisis and you had the surge in the 70s, you had one of the highest addiction rates. Was it in Europe?
Yep.
So after, fast forward now, let's say almost 20 years, the statistics I've seen is you've got the lowest now. Is that correct?
Yeah.
So I just want to kind of highlight that. It's not even a question, just that in 17 short years, you've overturned it from one of the worst addiction rates to one of the lowest.
Yes, that's true. But I insist, I must stress that in my view, this is not only the consequence of decriminalization itself. It's not the silver bullet. Okay? It's the complete package of policies that are developed in the same way. We had a financial crisis that led us to a lot of difficulties for several aspects. On one side, some people that had already reached some balance in their lives were confronted with increased difficulties, and we had a lot of relapses. We had lots of people smuggling drugs to survive. Okay. So it increased the pressure to the use. Okay. We had some budgetary cuts in the system, which we could more or less manage. We had to sacrifice some parts of it, for instance, knowledge, studies, polls. We have to sacrifice that, but we could stand mostly on the supply of care to people.
So you were still able to reach the addicts.
Yeah. I must say that everything that we offer, all those treatment programs, harm reduction, substitution treatment with methadone or buprenorphine or whatever, everything is free. So we are a quite poor country, but this is seen as an investment.
Yeah, so you're investing in the health of your people. An unusual concept.
That's it. It's not insurance. Yes, you may use cannabis. It's covered, but heroin is not. Okay, it's not the case. Okay, if you have any citizen, even people, foreigners living in Portugal, if they address a center seeking for help, they have help for free.
Yeah, well, I love that whole concept, because again, it's just, you know, if you are not an addict and you are healthy, and you know, your money goes to helping people who are worse off, then I think that's a kind of nice Christian type, you know, or whatever.
Yeah, but during the crisis, one of the consequences also was that we felt that the common citizen with no problems of this kind was not willing so much to help others. Mm-hmm. People tend to be more selfish during
when their life is good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a difficulty either.
Right. Now, I know we got to wrap up soon. I got two questions I really want to make sure we ask. First one, the prescription pain medication. Do you have an issue with addiction in Portugal with that? And if not, why compared to other places?
No. You know, we have very different tradition and very different training about the use of namely opiates. We use much less frequently opiates, even if we are trained and we are offered the possibility to prescribe when needed, really needed. Mm-hmm. But we do not over-prescribe.
Right.
Okay? This is a tradition. I think mostly in Europe we have different tradition towards opiates, namely, than in the United States or Canada.
I believe the U.S. uses 80% of the world's opiates.
Yeah, there's the pressure of the industry, a lot. And being a doctor in the Algarve, I remember having, I used to be called to the hotels to see tourists. Mm-hmm. I remember seeing Americans that had brought in their travel pharmacies opiates. It's unthinkable.
Oh, really? To have opiates on your...
No, it's not. But if you need, okay, you go to a doctor and someone prescribes you, but you do not bring, for the treatment of the ray or something like that, you don't bring opiates.
Yeah.
Okay? This is one difference. Another one, it's the control of prescription. All our opiates need a specific prescription, how do you call it, a special paper for the prescription,
yes.
Okay? And this prescription is controlled by a centralized body from all over the country, okay? Let's imagine that today I start prescribing opiates to all the people who come to my consultation, okay? The next day or the next month, I will receive a letter from the agency of medicines asking me what is happening in your practice, what kind of patients are you having that you need to prescribe so many opiates, okay? And of course they will not forbid me of prescribing, but at least I have to justify. I have some supervising body looking at my practice. And this is a kind of a pressure that it already happened to us. A couple of years ago, we noticed that buprenorphine has been over-prescribed in a region of Portugal.
Okay.
Okay? And then they focused and they found one specific doctor that was... We had the opportunity to discuss and to explain the difficulties and the problems that might arise from that over-prescription.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and it stopped. It ended. Yeah. So this control system is quite effective also.
Okay. Because yeah, I want to highlight that too. We have a huge opiate addiction, and it's largely from prescription pain meds now. And it's interesting because you're about to go to Ohio, which you'll probably be educated even more about that when you get there, because I know that's one of the nucleus.
Yes, we do not have much iatrogenic dependence, you know, on opiates.
Brilliant. All right, so the very last one, because I need to free you up in a moment. How do you try and help enable other countries to adopt their version of the model that you have?
That's the question. Their version, okay? I mean, well, we are happy with the attention that our model is having all over the world. And myself, personally, I work a lot on that. I travel a lot. Next week, I will travel to Mexico to share our experience. Why did not other countries adopt this model exactly, or the version of it? I think it's a question of demographics, where the problems are present. Drugs policy are very much used as a power tool. Yes. And when you, for instance, let's talk about Brazil, for instance. Okay? They tried to decriminalize.
Oh, really?
Yeah. But people tend to say, okay, the problems with drugs are in the favelas. That's where they must stay.
Mm-hmm. Okay? In the poor areas.
Poor. Mm-hmm. It's not an inclusive movement of having people involved in the normal society and with reassuming their rights. And so there's a tool to maintain the
mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's, I think, what has changed in America with the prescription opiate epidemic. And a few people have pointed it out. There's no classes, there's no colors to that. Opiates kill the very rich and the very poor and everyone in between. All right, well, thank you so much.
Welcome. It's a pleasure. Thank you for coming.